Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the January session of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The first case for oral argument this morning is Emily Fodness and others appellants versus the City of Sioux Falls Appellee. For the appellants, we have Mr. Daniel Fritz and Mr. Timothy Ron, attorneys from Sioux Falls. And I understand, Mr. Fritz, you'll be presenting this morning?
That is correct.
Very well. And for the appellee, we have Mr. James Moore, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Justice Salter has disqualified himself on this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Carmen Means, a circuit judge from the Third Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Salter's place. With that, Mr. Fritz, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. It's an honor to be back before this court. As this court knows, this case involves the very highly publicized collapse of the Copper Lounge building in downtown Sioux Falls that occurred on December 2nd, 2016. That event had rather tragic consequences for many people, including my clients. In particular, my client Emily Fodness was nearly killed in that accident. Quite frankly, should have been killed. She survived a miraculous survival, but has been left to live with physical injuries as well as suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, which, among other things, led to her being placed on a 72-hour suicide watch just months after this tragic event. This event, this tragedy, was caused through the negligence, and I'll go so far as to say the incompetence, of several individuals and several entities. One of those entities was the City of Sioux Falls. The City of Sioux Falls, in this case, is seeking to avoid its legal responsibility to my clients by claiming that it had no duty to my clients. It is making that claim through a misplaced resort to the public duty doctrine. The circuit court granted the city's motion to dismiss on a Rule 12 motion at the pleading stage of this case, before we were allowed to do any discovery, before we were allowed to weigh any of the facts in this case. We would submit that that was an error. We would submit that the circuit court erroneously applied the public duty doctrine to this case, and furthermore, erroneously ruled that our complaint failed to sufficiently plead the basis for the application of the special duty doctrine.
That isn't the public duty issue, isn't that kind of resolved by the McDowell case? I mean, is there really any way you get around that under McDowell?
I believe there is, for this reason. McDowell, Hagen, and McDowell were the two cases that looked at, shall we call them, construction building code type cases and the application of public duty doctrine to those types of cases. Hagen and McDowell stood for this, that when someone is making a claim that the city, and ironically, the City of Sioux Falls in all these cases, when someone is making the claim that the city, after issuing a permit, has a duty to go inspect the construction to ensure compliance with building codes, the public duty doctrine applies, no duty. That's a public duty. That is not a duty that that can be the source of any liability for the city. That's an entirely different claim than we are making in this case. The Circuit Court erred in applying Hagen and McDowell to our claims, assuming that they were the same. They're not. We are not claiming that the city in this case had a duty to go inspect the Copper Lounge demolition, or that it did inspect the Copper Lounge demolition and did it negligently. To the contrary, we are claiming that the city knowingly violated its own ordinances, violated the law, in issuing the permit in the first place. That is an entirely different claim, and I would submit that it's a claim of first impression to this court as to whether the public duty doctrine applies in that circumstance, when a governmental entity knowingly disregards the law and then causes harm. I'll tell you, there's guidance from Judge Kornman in Cloud v. the United States. I would submit that case is more similar, quite similar, to this case. In Cloud, Judge Kornman was faced with a law enforcement officer who arrested a driver, took him into custody, and then left the scene, leaving the car partially in the roadway. Another car came along and hit that car. Injured people sued the governmental entity. Governmental entity said, no duty. Special duty, or the public duty doctrine applies. We don't owe you a duty.
Was this duty created by a South Dakota statute or by municipal ordinance?
By a South Dakota statute in that case.
All right. No, I'm talking about your case.
In our case, a municipal ordinance.
That means that the city is setting up its own standard of care?
Well, I think they have they create a duty for certain, and that is to do, in this case, the ordinance says that if you're, and I'm paraphrasing, but it says in order to get a demolition permit, you must submit plans. You must submit plans that show how you're going to do the demolition to ensure that it's going to be done safe. And those plans have to be approved by a licensed engineer or architect. They issued the permit without plans. They ignored the ordinance.
That in the rec, is there evidence in the record that they knew the demolition was ongoing?
It's alleged in the, but we didn't get to the point where we could solicit any evidence. It's alleged. And for Rule 12 purposes, we must assume it to be true if it's alleged. And yes.
Can you explain how, If we have to take as pled those facts to be true, but if the city did in fact issue the permit without the required construction plans,
right?
Can you then explain how that equates to the factors that have to be established to show the duty, and particularly how that equates to knowledge of the uniquely dangerous situation of this particular building?
Okay. Thank you. And that takes us then to the application of the special duty exception. But for purposes of the public duty doctrine, back to your question, I think it's a unique case that the court should look to Cloud v. United States for guidance on whether the public duty doctrine applies at all. Judge Kornman would say it does not. I would urge this court to follow that lead. To the question of how does that ignorance of the ordinance affect the factors that must be applied with regard to the special duty doctrine, special duty exception, here's what we've pled in our complaint and what must then be assumed to be true for Rule 12 purposes. We have pled, and it must be assumed to be true, the city knew that Hultgren Construction, the contractor, had a long history of violating the terms of its permits. They knew this guy didn't follow the rules. They knew that he was seeking a demolition permit for the Copper Lounge building. They knew that what the plan was for the Copper Lounge building was to convert what was then two spaces separated by a 90-foot load-bearing wall into one open space. necessarily the city knew, and we must assume to be true, that that would require the removal of the load-bearing wall. They knew further, and it's alleged in the complaint, that my clients lived above the space where this demolition was going to take place. And they knew further that they lived in an apartment that was supported in part by that load-bearing wall. With all of that, they advised, this is alleged in the complaint as well, the city advised Hultgren Construction, you can't get this demolition permit unless you produce plans as required by the ordinance. What happened? For whatever reason, that we'll hopefully get an answer to at some point. He comes in, applies for the permit, no plans, they issue the permit. Despite the advice they'd given him, despite the knowledge they had about what was going to happen at the Copper Lounge building, despite the knowledge they had about this man's past history, they issued that permit. He took that permit, went back to the Copper Lounge building, and almost immediately began deconstructing the load-bearing wall. The removal of the load-bearing wall led to the collapse, which led to my client's injuries.
But where in that process does the city know that the contractor is not going to take the precautions necessary before removing the load-bearing wall?
Well, they don't know. All they know is that a load-bearing wall is going to be removed, which is a dangerous condition. So they are aware that a... Now, do they have to know how he's going to do it? I would point this court to the Lautit versus City of Deadwood case. It was a federal district court case. Judge Batty. In that case, the City of Deadwood allowed wires to be laid across the city street for a party that they were having in Deadwood. Imagine that. And they didn't lay the wires. The city didn't lay the wires. They didn't know how the wires were going to be laid. They never even observed the wires after they'd been laid. They simply allowed the wires to be laid. Someone trips, gets hurt. The court said the fact that they allowed those wires was sufficient to put them on notice, actual notice or actual knowledge of a dangerous condition. I would submit in this case, they allowed Hultgren Construction, a known violator of permits, to go and remove a load-bearing wall in a 100-century-old brick building in downtown Sioux Falls. I think that gives them actual knowledge, or at least we've pled enough. That's really important here. We've pled enough to allow us to go forward on the issue of whether that is actual knowledge of a dangerous condition in this case.
Let's assume that we come to the conclusion that you've sufficiently pled actual knowledge under element one.
Mm-hmm.
Is that enough? Is actual knowledge? I mean, I know that's important, but is that alone enough?
Yeah. The Sarace case, which was decided by Judge Lang in federal district court, would say no, it's not. Because that was exactly what happened in that case. He found that there was sufficiently pled actual notice, actual knowledge, but the complaint was devoid of any allegations regarding the other three factors.
Can you address those factors now, especially the reliance factor?
Yes. Let me say that I would submit that we have sufficiently pled actual knowledge, and we've sufficiently pled the fourth factor, which is a breach of a duty of care that caused an increased risk of harm. The reliance factor is really quite difficult, and I don't know of a case where the court has found it to have existed. It has to be a personal assurance. I can't imagine, in this case, the city coming, knocking on my client's door saying, hey, you're safe. It's not going to happen. So, but I think we have pled the two that I identified, and that is sufficient. Two has been found to be sufficient. And in this case, it's the same facts or the same allegations that I just summarized give rise to the same conclusion that that pleads a sufficient case of a breach of duty of care by the city that increased the risk of harm to my clients.
So is there an ordinance that requires that the plans and specifications must be filed before the or before the building permit is issued?
Yes.
And which ordinance is that?
It's and I have to apologize because it was miscited in our brief. It's one ordinance 150.017. It takes a little bit of gymnastics here. That ordinance adopts the International Building Code or portions of it. In 2015, which is what applied in this case, it applied the 2015 International Building Code. In the International Building Code, it's section 107.1 and 3303.1. Now, in fairness, that says that plans shall be submitted before the permit is issued. There is an exception. It says unless the building official finds that this is the nature of the work is not such that such plans are necessary. We have alleged breach of the ordinance for this purpose, because we haven't been allowed to go forward for this purpose. This court, the circuit court, should have, this court must assume that to be true. So must assume the exception doesn't apply, that they violated the ordinance. We've alleged it. We must assume it to be true. And so if they did, in fact, if the city did, in fact, breach its own ordinance, and frankly, the requirement of plans is the only indicia of safety that the city necessarily has before it issues a permit. Otherwise, what is a permit? What does it mean? What it means to the residents of Sioux Falls is that the city at least has been presented plans approved by an engineer or architect that says this work will be done safely. That's all the city has to do. Look, did you present those plans? Yes. Permit. To the public, that means they've been presented those plans. Well, when they disregard that, what does that permit mean? It means nothing. It means somebody paid a fee for a piece of paper. So I would submit that by violating the ordinance, by disregarding it, in fact, we allege that they advised Hallgren that you're going to need to submit plans. They knew the ordinance. They knew that's what was required. They told him you're going to need that. And for whatever reason, he comes in, applies, no plans, they issue the permit. I think it's important for the special duty doctrine to understand the evolution of it a bit, in that it used to be a single factor test that was determined solely by a legal question. And that legal question was, is the statute that's implicated, the ordinance that's implicated, is it designed to protect the public as a whole or a particular class of people? When that was the test, the single factor test, these cases were ripe for review at the pleading stage because it was a legal question. Rule 12 would be a good time to determine if you've sufficiently pled the application of the special duty doctrine. That whole analysis changed with Tipton. In Tipton, the court said, no, we're no longer going to employ the single factor test. We're going to follow the lead of the Minnesota Supreme Court in Craycraft, and we're going to consider three additional factors at least. This court in Tipton said those additional three factors are fact-based factors. They're not legal questions like the one factor, which still applies. These are fact-based factors that require a weighing of the evidence. Since Tipton, the parties in this case I counted cited 17 cases to this court that are in Minnesota, Craycraft, and beyond, and in South Dakota, Tipton and beyond. So in other words, cases where Minnesota courts or South Dakota courts use this four-part test. In 15 of those 17 cases, it came to the appellate court via a motion for summary judgment or a jury verdict. In 15 of the 17 cases, the case was allowed to proceed beyond the pleading stage through discovery until a point in time when the trier in fact was able to weigh the evidence on whether these factors apply. The other two cases, one is Radke out of Minnesota, where the lower court granted a Rule 12 motion to dismiss like they did in this case. The Minnesota Supreme Court reversed. In that case, they said you should not have granted a Rule 12 motion to dismiss because now under the Craycraft framework, these factors require a weighing of the evidence. We need to let these cases move beyond the pleading stage to a fact-weighing stage of the case. So in 16 of the 17 cases cited by the two parties in this case, the courts, those cases were allowed to proceed beyond the pleading stage to a fact-weighing stage of the case. I would submit this court should follow the lead of those 16 out of 17 cases. The city will rely heavily on the one outlier case, and that's the Sarace case.
Okay, your time has expired, okay. Counsel. Thank you.
Thank you. For those reasons, I'd ask for reversal. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Moore, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, James Moore on behalf of the city of Sioux Falls. Justice Jensen, I think the answer to your question, which was can we get to a special duty in this case even if there's no actual knowledge? I think the answer is if there's only actual knowledge, I think the answer to that is no. This court's cases, and there are eight of them since 1990, to decide this case, you don't have to go anywhere beyond the eight cases that this court has decided on the public duty doctrine and the special duty rule since 1990 in the Hagen case. But the cases make clear that you have to have a combination of factors. One factor alone is not enough. And I think the real question is whether you can have a special duty where there's no reasonable reliance by the plaintiff. And Mr. Fritz more or less just conceded that he can't establish that on the facts of this case. It was not pleaded. In fact, the opposite was pleaded. The complaint specifically says that the city did not make any representations about the building permit or the work that was ongoing. To the Fodness family, in paragraphs 17 and 18, it says, failed to notify the Fodness family. And I think that to get to a special duty, you have to analyze the four factors in this case. Mr. Fritz, in his brief, conceded the third factor. There's no statute or ordinance in this case that creates a special duty to a particular plaintiff, in this case, the Fodness family. And we know that not only because he's conceded it, but we know that because the only thing that's pleaded is the violation of the city's building code. And you have to accept, based on the facts of the complaint, that the city issued a building permit that it should not have issued. You have to accept that that demolition plans were required for the permit that the city issued. And I think, ultimately, there's different facts that explain what actually happened. But for purposes of this case, you assume that to be true. One, it does not establish the first factor, which is actual knowledge of a violation of law constituting a dangerous condition. The only thing it establishes is a violation of the building code. And this court has said in the McDowell case and in the Hagen case, violation of a building code is not sufficient to create a special duty to a particular person or class of persons. So how do we get to actual knowledge? In the Walther case, which is the case where Melissa Walther was assaulted and raped by her boyfriend, the court said that the law enforcement officers in that case did not have actual knowledge of a violation of law constituting a dangerous condition. And the court says in paragraph 3 that what was necessary is knowledge that Siler, the boyfriend, the attacker, would later attack Melissa Walther. There had been a confrontation. The law enforcement officers had knowledge of calls to the police. They had knowledge of a volatile relationship. And this court said no actual knowledge because there was not knowledge of what actually occurred. It has to be a very particular kind of knowledge. It has to be unique to the facts and circumstances of the case. In the Gleason case, which involved an underage drinking party that law enforcement knew about and were trying to do something about, there was an assault that occurred at the party. And in paragraph 16, in addressing the actual knowledge requirement, this court said that what was required was knowledge that failure to stop the party would result in the assault that occurred, an assault. It has to be very particular. And in this case, I think what was clearly required is knowledge that the city knew the demolition of a load-bearing wall was underway. The city knew that the shoring that Hultgren Construction was using to support the structure of the building while that demolition was underway was inadequate. And that it nevertheless allowed the work to proceed. As Mr. Fritz indicated, there's no allegations in the complaint of those facts. All that we have is violation of a building code.
You know, Mr. Fritz said, what is the purpose of a building permit? And in McDowell, we said that the issuance of a building permit does not imply that the plans submitted are in compliance with all applicable codes. So if a permit's not a representation that plans will be built to code or comply with any standard of care, what is the purpose of a building permit?
I think the purpose of a building permit ultimately is to make sure that the buildings are constructed pursuant to the code that is established. But what the court has said is that the purpose of the permit is not to place the responsibility for ensuring compliance upon the city. The responsibility for the compliance rests squarely on the person responsible for construction. And that's the language in both the McDowell case and in the Hagen case. Responsibility for compliance rests on the person responsible for construction, in this case, Hultgren Construction. So again, the purpose of the special duty rule is, I think, You create a special duty where a governmental entity has essentially taken some affirmative action that voluntarily assumes a duty, and the language that this court has used is it constitutes a policy choice that the governmental entity, whether it's a municipality or a state or a county, is going to expend its resources in a particular way. And it's going to do that in such a way that it assumes responsibility for the safety of a particular person or a class of persons. And that's not what has occurred in this case. The rationale supporting the public duty rule is that it promotes accountability for offenders. And that's paragraph 10 from the Gleason case, that responsibility should not fall on local governments where they have not made the sort of policy choice that they're going to be responsible for the safety of a particular person or class of persons. In the Walther case, paragraph 17, the general rule is that there is no duty to prevent the misconduct of a third person. In this case, Hultgren Construction, that was taking down a load-bearing wall without proper shoring, of which the city had no actual knowledge. In the second Tipton versus Town of Tabor case, the court talks about the allocation of limited resources and not wanting to motivate a governmental entity to act simply to avoid liability. Those are the purposes that support the special duty rule. And again, in eight cases decided since 1990, this court has not found facts sufficient to establish a special duty rule under the analysis of the four factors. So in this case, I don't think that there is evidence of actual knowledge that is unique to this case. And it has to be knowledge that the city knew that the demolition work was ongoing, that it was unsafe because there was not shoring, and that the building was likely to collapse as a result, and it did nothing. Well, those facts are not alleged.
Let me stop you there. When you say evidence of, I mean, part of the problem here is we're dealing with this on a motion to dismiss. There is no evidence. We've got allegations, and there's allegations that the city knew these people were living in the building. They knew they were going to demolish it. They knew they were going to take out a load-bearing wall. Those are facts that seem to suggest that there was some knowledge on the part of the city that there was a potentially dangerous condition there that the city was issuing a permit for, and they knew that there was an architectural plan. So we don't have the facts developed on those, but we have some allegations that suggest there's a dangerous condition that may affect the Fodnes family.
Constructive knowledge. All you get to is constructive knowledge.
Well, maybe until we develop the facts.
No, because you have to accept the facts in the complaint as true. And my motion accepts the facts as true. And Judge Thieler accepted the facts in the complaint as true. And what they establish is a violation of a building code. Not evidence of actual knowledge, not constructive knowledge, actual knowledge that the city knew that the building was likely to collapse if it issued the permit. That's what's required to prove actual knowledge in this case, and I think that's clearly supported by this court's cases, and in particular, the McDowell case and the Hagen case, because if you relax the requirement of actual knowledge in this case, which alleges at the end of the day violation of a building code, then how do you make sense of the McDowell and the Hagen cases where the language is extremely broad? It says, quote, building codes do not create a duty of care that will support a negligence claim. So if you go from the general public duty doctrine and that broad statement to the special duty rule, which this court has described as an exception to the public duty doctrine or a corollary to the public duty doctrine. And now you're going to establish not only the first factor of actual knowledge, but the fourth factor, which we haven't yet talked about, which is increased risk of harm. If you're going to establish both of those factors by saying that the city violated its own building code in issuing the permit, then how have you not circumvented the public duty rule in the first place, the general rule? And that's I think that's the tricky part in accepting any part of Mr. Fritz's argument, even in the context of a motion to dismiss.
Right, and accepting the, as pled, they didn't do that. We didn't do that in Hagen. We didn't do that in McDowell. We addressed those on motion for summary judgment where the facts are developed in the record. You know, you talk about building plans, but I don't hear you talk about the fact the city had knowledge they were taking a load-bearing wall out. That seems significant.
But knowledge that a load-bearing wall is coming out is not knowledge of a dangerous condition. That's something that happens all the time in building construction. The city, based on the allegations in the complaint, you have to go one step farther and show that the city knew that it was not going to be done correctly because the shoring was not going to support the building during the construction.
And isn't that when we bring expert witnesses in to tell us what's the risk and what should the city have understood in that situation?
But the complaint hasn't pleaded that. And for purposes of the motion to amend, which Mr. Fritz did not address orally today, but which is addressed in the briefs, when he made the motion to amend the complaint, he did not attach a proposed amended complaint, and he did not suggest, here are the facts that I think I can actually prove if I'm allowed to amend that would satisfy that concern. What he says is, I want leave to amend so that I can add any technical or magic language that might be necessary. This is not a technical or magic language issue. This is do you have facts that would establish that the city actually knew of a dangerous condition unique to the facts of this case and that it nevertheless went ahead? And the answer is no. I am not a fan of motions to dismiss as a practicing lawyer. I file them very, very rarely. I know that the standard's high. I know that judges don't like them. I know that if your motion to dismiss is denied, it makes it harder to get summary judgment at a later point. I don't like them. I think it is perfectly appropriate to have filed a motion to dismiss in this case because the allegations of the complaint are insufficient. There is no set of facts based on the allegations in the complaint, assuming them to be true, that would establish any combination of the four factors in this case.
Can you address the fourth factor, the increased risk of harm?
Yeah, I think it's the hardest one. Again, my reading of the complaint is that it's not, and I should be clear, Your Honor, it's not the hardest one from my perspective in defending the case and in supporting the circuit court's decision, I think it's the hardest one to understand what it actually means. What this court has said is that negligence isn't enough with respect to increasing the risk of harm, that failure to diminish the harm isn't enough, that failure to act isn't enough. And what the complaint alleges is simply negligence issuance of a building permit. And I think that Mr. Fritz is relying on the same facts with respect to the first and the fourth factors. And if you argue that, I think the best construction you can put on it for Mr. Fritz's case is that without the building permit, Hultgren Construction should not have proceeded. Therefore, by issuing the building permit, it necessarily increased the risk of harm. If that analysis were correct, then the fourth factor would be meaningless in the context of a building permit case. And now you're back to the issue of what sense does the Hagen case and the McDowell case make if that's actually true. It has to be something more than that. It has to be some, again, affirmative conduct by the city that actually increases the risk of harm. And I think rather than tying it in some way to the first factor on actual knowledge, it could be tied to the reasonable reliance factor, in which the city knows that the Hultgrens are, not only knows that the Hultgrens are living in the building during construction, the Fodness family is living in the building during construction, but the Fodness family has some conversation with the city in which the city says, nope, we've got this, don't worry about it, we know what they're doing, and it's fine for you to stay there.
Other than your analogy, are you aware of any cases that tie the second and the fourth factor together?
No, I'm not. And again, I scoured the eight decisions that I mentioned and tried to find good facts or a reference to analogous facts or facts that would be sufficient to establish that. And I can't come up with anything terribly helpful to the court today. And so what I fall back on for purposes of supporting the decision that Judge Thieler reached is that negligence isn't enough. And a failure to you have to do something that actually increases the harm or the risk. And I don't know what that would be in this case, but I don't think it exists. And if you take that away and you take away the third factor, which Mr. Fritz has conceded, and you take away reasonable reliance, which he has more or less conceded today in response to Justice Devaney's question, at best, you're left with actual knowledge. And if you were to find that that the allegations of the complaint were sufficient to prove actual knowledge, I think again you go back to this court's cases, including the Tipton case, the second Tipton case, where the court first applied the four factors, and you can't get past the fact that there's only one factor, because this court said that there was evidence of actual knowledge in the Tipton case, and nevertheless it affirmed summary judgment on the basis that there was no duty in that case. So in a nutshell, eight decisions since 1990, and none of them has this court found a special duty. I don't think that this is the case, even when it was decided on a motion to dismiss, in which the court can find a special duty. You have to go through the four factors. And I simply don't think there's any allegations in the complaint that would establish any combination of the four factors. Keep in mind the complaint is very spare in this case. It is 30 paragraphs total. The facts related to liability are in paragraphs 5 through 18. So you have 13 paragraphs with facts related to liability. There are no dates. There are no names, there are no customers, there are no other projects, there are no permit numbers.
Right, but you're putting more burden on the plaintiff than what they have in terms of a pleading rule, wouldn't you agree?
I don't think so. When the law is clearly established, as it is in this case, I think that the complaint was carefully pleaded, and it was carefully pleaded in a vague way. There is clearly an attempt to satisfy the special duty factors without specifically saying, we know that we have to establish a special duty factor, and in this case, here are the facts that establish actual knowledge, here are the facts that establish reasonable reliance, here are the facts that establish an increased risk of harm. It doesn't go through and do that. But when you read it, you can understand what it's trying to do, and I think that the way it's pleaded is a result of the fact that the plaintiffs do not have the facts to establish what's necessary to prove a special duty in this case, and that's why I think that the dismissal is appropriate. I have nothing else unless you have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Mr. Fritz, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Let me address a few of the comments made by Mr. Moore. He mentions the eight cases that have been decided since, I believe, since Tipton, since 1990. And Justice Jensen, you appropriately pointed out the one thing that Mr. Moore failed to mention about those eight cases. In each of those eight cases, the cases proceeded beyond the stage where we're at in this case today. They got to go through discovery in those eight cases. They got to present the evidence to the trier of fact and have the trier of fact weigh whether the factors exist or not. We're being denied that opportunity. In those eight cases, we can only assume that the counsel for the governmental entity either chose not to bring a motion to dismiss, a Rule 12 motion to dismiss, or they did and the court denied. In any event, the cases were allowed to proceed. Ours was not. Second, it was mentioned that building codes cannot serve as a basis for liability against the city. It's important, these terms, it's in Hagen and McDowell, it was the contractor's violation of the building code, which they said those violations cannot serve as a basis of liability for the city, a contractor's violation of the building code. We're alleging here the city itself violated its own ordinances as a result of the building code by virtue of its adoption. It's the city's violation. That's why this case is different. This case, the claims in this case are different than the claims asserted in Hagen or McDowell, because it's the city itself that is violating its own ordinances in this case and knowingly doing so. The two factors, first of all, I don't know if I heard Mr. Moore correctly, that, but I don't think there's any question that pleading in this case or establishing through evidence in the other cases needs to be more than two factors. There's no authority for that. In fact, I think the authority suggests that if you do establish two of the factors, that is sufficient to establish the special duty doctrine. And therefore, I do believe that we have pled, and that's the difficult part here, is we're still in notice pleading state. My client, let me read one paragraph out of the complaint. We allege that upon information and belief, the defendant, city, knew that the issuance of demolition permits for a structure in which plaintiffs were known to reside without adequate architectural or structural plans, and to a contractor who explicitly intended to remove portions of an interior load-bearing wall and was known to be in violation of its past and current permits, would substantially increase the risk of injury or death to the plaintiffs. We allege that knowledge. We have to assume the city had that knowledge. We've never been given the opportunity to explore the evidence related to that knowledge. We fully intend to prove that. But to say that we haven't pled the basis for going forward on a claim of actual knowledge, I would suggest is not fair to my clients. Actual knowledge, they would suggest, mean actual knowledge that he, that Holdgren Construction was actually tearing down this wall. Well, courts have said it's sufficient to show, this court has said, it's sufficient to show they must have known. But when you issue a demolition permit to someone, knowing that the plans are to remove a load-bearing wall, must you not have known? Do they have to go over there and see the sledgehammers being swung? I don't think so. When you issue a demolition permit to someone who you know is going to remove a load-bearing wall, must you not know that that is what's going to take place?
But how can you leap from the cited language in paragraph 14 that knowledge of an alleged violation of past and current permits would substantially increase the risk of injury and death to plaintiffs if they would improperly, you have to leap from that to the fact that they would improperly fail to shore up a wall during demolition that would lead to this harm. That's the stretch that I'm struggling with as far as the actual knowledge factor.
I would direct this court to a couple of other cases in which they found actual knowledge. One being the Radke case in Minnesota. Radke was a case of a daycare center. The county had inspected it or had a duty to inspect it. They found in that case, Radke, they specifically, the court said, there was no evidence that they knew of any physical or sexual abuse, which turned out to be what happened at that daycare center. There was no evidence that they knew of any physical or sexual abuse at the daycare center. But they did have knowledge that it was overcrowded. The court said the knowledge of it being overcrowded was enough to impute actual knowledge. And by the way, again, this was on summary judgment after depositions, after discovery, after weighing of the facts, that the knowledge of overcrowding was enough to impute knowledge of the dangerous condition of physical or sexual abuse at the daycare center. I would submit this is a better case for actual knowledge than that one. I'd submit that in Tipton involved these dogs that were dangerous. Now, in Tipton, eventually they got to, after a weighing of the evidence, they determined there was no actual knowledge. I'll grant that. But in Tipton 1, importantly, the court said, I'm going to remand it to the trial court to do a factual weighing of the evidence as to whether the city had actual knowledge of the dangerous condition in that case. They got to go to the factual weighing.
In your paragraph 14, you know, one of your analogy and your reference to Radke, there was knowledge of a specific fact. You know, here you allege a knowledge of violation of past and current permits, but it doesn't allege what types of violations. You know, so I'm kind of struggling to apply that knowledge here. There could be all sorts of violations of building codes and permits that may have nothing to do with structural issues. So how do we get there from the what's pled in the complaint?
I guess the import of that knowledge that he violated, again, I would go back to, keep in mind we are in notice pleading state. When you plead a negligence case, you plead a duty, a breach, causation, damage. Do we need to plead every nuance that has been exacted on each one of those elements by the courts over time in order to plead those elements? No. You need to plead the elements. We've pled, now, to your question, they knew this was a contractor who disregarded the terms of permits. Is it specifically like the case not necessarily. What the point is this is a man, this is a contractor who was sloppy, who was not a rule follower, who would not do what he was told to do. That's the point. Not necessarily that he had been in this exact situation before and was going to do the same thing here, but for that matter, I'm not even sure that knowledge is all that important, because they issued a permit that didn't have any plans. So I don't know how he couldn't comply with the permit, because there was nothing binding him. There should have been. There should have been plans submitted, and he should have. And again, we're not claiming the city didn't review those plans and should have checked them for building code violation. They just didn't require it. And so I think this is a case of the city violating the code itself, not a contractor violating the code, the city violating the code, different than Hagen and McDowell, and the court should follow the lead of Judge Kornman in Cloud v. the United States and say that the special or the public duty doctrine does not apply in this case. I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.